You're listening to the Corner House podcast, available from www.cornerhouse.org.
Buongiorno, and welcome to this week's Corner House podcast. I'm your host, Sarah Perks, Program and Engagement Director here, and I'm joined by my very regular contributors, Andy Willis from the University of Salford, and Rachel Hayward, who is our Program Manager for Film. This week, we focus on Greg Araki's new film, Kaboom, and we discuss this week's big news story on censorship. I'll also be giving you my personal Venice Biennale highlights, and that's rounded off by our regular What's On and our staff recommendation of the week. Let's start things off by talking about this week's new release, Kaboom. I'm first of all going to test Rachel and Andy on what they know about the US indie auteur Greg Araki. So come on, tell us what you know.
This is his 10th feature.
The most well-known film, well, his breakout film, I think, was 1992's The Living End. But he's made a number of other well-known films. Rachel, do you know any of them?
Mysterious Skin is most definitely my favourite one and probably the one that's most well-known with Corner House audiences.
Now, the thing that I was most surprised about with Greg Araki, and well, I don't know why I was surprised, but when I looked him up on the internet was, by God, he looks good for 51.
It's probably because he's made a career out of making films about college kids, usually the messed up ones, which is kind of what we see in Kaboom as well.
And I do believe he was married for a short while, which I was also surprised about.
Most famously, his films are within the new queer film movement from the early 90s.
Yes, and Paul Bartel, who's a great hero of mine, who was the director of Death Race 2000, he appears in The Living End, along with his wife, Mary Warrenoff. And having watched Kaboom, I have to say I'm not surprised that he had a friendship or working relationship with Paul Bartel.
Ah, if we're playing that game, who stars in which film, the lead in Kaboom is Thomas Dekker from All About Evil, which we screened here last year as part of Abandon Normal Devices Festival.
Thank you for that outline, or whatever it was, about Greg Araki, the US indie auteur. So let's move on to the film Kaboom. Andy, tell us a bit about the film.
Well, there's a line in the film which for me summed it up, and that is, strange is the new normal. And that was very much, I thought, where Kaboom was coming from. It's about two best friends, Smith and Stella, who... it never tells you what the college is, so I decided to give the college that they're at a name, and I've called it Beautiful People's College USA. There's not an ugly or even slightly ordinary-looking student there, rather like Salford University. Now, I've come up in the spirit of a college university-set film with a formula to try and give you a flavour of what Kaboom's like. The plot, I think, is just a bit too out there to try and sum up in a few moments. So I've come up with a formula. And my formula for Kaboom, should you want to make one at home, is 1950s American monster movie plus Roger Corman 1970s exploitation attitude times by conspiracy thriller plus snappy and smart dialogue plus arty student fashion victims equals Kaboom.
Yay. Okay, that's a brilliant formula, and I think everyone should be coming up with their own for other films very soon. Okay then, Andy, so what did you actually think about the film?
Well, I have to say, I loved it. I didn't think I was going to. Some of Greg Araki's earlier films I've not been overly keen on, but this one, after about 5 to 10 minutes, I was wondering, oh, am I going to get on with this? But then it seemed to click in my mind and everything just fell into place and I was laughing along with it. It's kind of clever but not too smart-assed. And I think, in a sense, it takes a 50-year-old man to make a film about an 18-year-old man. And maybe that's why I got it. But yeah, I thought it was absolutely fabulous. The performances, once you get into the mood of the film, they're absolutely spot on. Just enough tongue-in-cheek, but not too much. And as you can imagine, a Greg Araki film, lots of other things in cheek as well as tongues.
Yeah, I mean, I really enjoyed this. At first, I thought, oh, it's too similar to something like Heartbeats. It's just young people having sex, that's about it. But it's not. It just suddenly like changes pace and goes to a place that I really didn't think it was going to go to. But you really do, you're in for the journey, you want to know what happens. It's really different from anything I've seen for quite some time, in a really kooky, fun, all those sort of, you know, things that Andy mentioned are there. It's playing on lots of different previous films and genres in such a fun way. I think it's a really special treat. Rachel, what did you think?
I think for me and for so many of our audience, it's going to be the perfect summer film. It's a really smartly done film. It's really funny, completely outlandish. It is going to be a cult classic in 5 years' time. And something that's always a bonus when you watch loads of films, it's 85 minutes long.
Okay, and so who do you think should go and watch this film? So we all like it, but who in particular should seek it out, Andy?
Well, I know it's a corny to say it's kind of got something for everyone, but I kind of think it has. If you're a sci-fi geek, it's got lots of sci-fi potential references. If you're into new queer cinema, there's lots of things that you'll recognise from Gregor Aki's earlier films. If you're into high school films or college films, it kind of takes the mickey out of that genre. If you like just watching beautiful people with beautiful haircuts, brackets, so they think, close brackets, then it's good for that. I think it's got something for everyone, and I rarely say that, but I really was quite surprised with how much I liked it, and I would recommend it to anyone, because I wouldn't have me down as someone who would love this film, so I think anyone would probably like it, if that's anything to go by.
Okay, so a very positive review for all of us for Kaboom. Kaboom starts screening from tomorrow, Friday the 10th of June. It'll be on for at least a week. Do check our website for all the times. And I'm also going to add in here now that we've got digital projection and Cinema 3. Rachel, tell us what that means for you.
From an audience perspective, it's really exciting because Cinema 3, the image is a lot crisper now. Films are going to look really, really good in there. From a programmer's point of view, this is the geeky, boring bit. Myself and another Rachel in the program team are very, very happy that lots of admin headaches and lots of programming glitches are now just all gone. It's all very exciting.
Okay, and we have another film opening called Love Like Poison. This opened actually a few weeks ago, but now we're showing it this week. And I didn't actually see this yet, but Andy has. So Andy, give us a quick review of Love Like Poison.
Well, after the last, if people have listened to the podcast over the past few weeks, a term that's come up again and again is coming-of-age film. Well, this is another coming-of-age film. I don't think you could call it anything else, really. If Kaboom's about 18-year-olds, this one's about a 14-year-old girl in rural France. She's kind of becoming, as she develops as a teenager, becoming more aware of her own sexuality. It's coming up to her confirmation. She's become obsessed with religion. There's a kind of intensity and confusion within her character, which I thought the film worked through really, really well. There's also, just for good measure, if she's not confused enough, a dishy Italian priest who's also confused, and his sexuality is also awakening, even though he's a few years older. So you can see it's got that kind of heady brew of passion and sex and a lovely rural idyll. It's also, I have to say, got a rather odd grandfather in it, who, as the film progresses, begins he seems quite nice, but then there are some, what I would only describe as some quite lurid scenes. One where he gets a nice bed bath by his granddaughter, and another one where he asks a particular question, which if you come to see the film, you'll know exactly what I mean. But for all that, I did find those things a bit, and it did. The film itself did sort of linger on the 14-year-old girl in quite an uncomfortable way at moments. But I suppose, get in touch if you don't agree with this following statement. That's French cinema for you. But overall, I have to say, it was quite simply shot, very effective in the way that it was shot. It wasn't hysterical. I mean, considering what I've just said about some of the lurid aspects of it, it wasn't a hysterical film at all. It was quite subdued. A very good performance by Clara Ogada as Anna, the central character. And the treat of treats for me, and hopefully for other people listening, Philippe Duclos, the actor who you may not know his name, but you will recognise him as Judge Robin from TV Spiral, and he gives a lovely little performance as the, I think he's a bishop, who is leader of the ceremony when the school children are getting confirmed. So it had lots of interesting things, again, weighing in at under 90 minutes, so another nice, short, snappy film. Simple, effective, first-time feature film from the director, and I thought, whilst Kaboom was all sort of stylish and flashy and snappy and snazzy, this was much more subdued, but I thought an equally interesting film.
Okay, Rachel, have you seen Love Like Poison?
I have indeed. I think that the particular mixture of Catholicism and sexual awakening, particularly in teenagers, is a really interesting theme, and it is something that's been explored an awful lot, particularly in my favourite film director's work, Terence Davies. It's something that comes up all the time. And so if you are a fan of French films, then this is definitely going to be one for you.
Okay, thank you both. I'm also going to get your opinions on this week's hot film news. I've heard that The Human Centipede 2 has been banned outright. So that means no one's allowed to see it on any format. You may remember that we showed The Human Centipede as a one-off screening a few months ago that was actually very popular ahead of its DVD release. So, Andy, what do you think about this banning business?
Well, I'm never happy with somebody in a kind of dark room deciding what I can and can't watch. I'm pretty sure most people who are listening feel that they certainly are in a position to decide what films they will watch in the cinema or on DVD at home or downloading or whatever format they might choose to legally watch those films. So I'm pretty dismayed, actually. I thought we'd gone past the days when the BBFC would not allow anything to be shown in any way, shape or form. A few little trims here and there would probably usually these days, I think, get things through. So I was actually quite surprised when I heard about it.
Well, usually the BBFC, the certification body, would give a window of around 6 months with some recommendations for cuts. So I wonder maybe if that's what they're going to do for this one.
When it came to the original Human Centipede, when we do these sort of one-off screenings, we take them home and watch them to make sure that it's, you know, something that we want to do. But I'd got confused and thought it was a Belgian art house film or something. Put it in the DVD player and had a little bit of a shock. But having said that, I still thought, you know, I thought it works as a film. I could tell the kind of mood it was portraying, what it was referencing. Of course, it was really over-the-top horror and such a silly premise. So bearing all that in mind, how bad do you think the second part's going to be? How bad can it be? What else can they add to the concepts of the Human Centipede apart from perhaps more people?
Well, for me, I mean, it's more to do with the fact that people are saying, well, it might not upset me, but there will be people out there who will go crazy if they watch this kind of film. So it's really, I think, the actual content. There's plenty of films out... Well, when we think about the content, there's plenty of films out there that I find quite abhorrent in terms of their content and the ideas that they're putting forward. But they're usually advertised on the side of a bus and promoted by big multinational conglomerates from Hollywood. So maybe, you know, there's different attitudes in different types of films, and I find it very unnerving when... just because films have certain types of content or have certain things in them that they get, either heavily censored if it's brought back in 6 months or told that they're not able to be shown at all. It's not good, I don't think.
And Rachel, do you think it's a bit of a silly move because everyone's now just going to download it anyway off the internet?
Absolutely. I'm just dying to say they just need to make it more tongue-in-cheek.
Kaboom.
Okay, right, at that point I think, well, you know, let us know what you think, send in your comments, Twitter, email, and we're going to go now to the quick fire round, if I can compose Rachel and Andy and get them to think. So we're going to start with best films set in college. Andy?
Well, I would go back, I think, old school, proper old school, as we're talking about college, to 1940 and Laurel and Hardy's A Chump at Oxford, and I believe there's been many chumps at Oxford since then.
Okay, Rachel.
Mine's not quite as old school as that. It's back as when I was at school, would be Heathers. It's got good memories for me.
Yeah, mine's on a similar vein. It's Cruel Intentions. It's a reworking of Dangerous Liaisons with Sarah Michelle Gellar. And also the inspiration for me dyeing my hair dark brown. Okay, next one. Film set in Venice. Andy.
Trying to be a bit offbeat again, as that's a kind of theme today, I'll go for Moonraker, the James Bond film. I can't stand James Bond films, but I do remember in Moonraker there's that crazy scene where the gondola becomes a hovercraft and goes across the big main square. And if I can remember it from a James Bond film, it must have really struck a chord.
Rachel?
More classic than offbeat, mine would be Visconti's Death in Venice.
Great film. And I'm going to have Don't Look Now, which is, of course, probably the film everyone thinks of when they think about Venice. And I was doing my own impression of the film last week as I wandered around late at night, lost in the dark. I didn't actually see the red coats anywhere, however. Okay, last one, best religious film. Rachel?
A recent one that was very, very popular here, which I loved, and I know Andy is a big fan of, was Of Gods and Men.
Well, for myself... Having gone to a Catholic school in the 1970s, we were sat down and forced to watch every year The Song of Bernadette. So The Song of Bernadette will be my choice.
I don't know why, but I really, really like Martin Scorsese's The Last Temptation of Christ with Willem Dafoe, who's coming to our city soon. So that's my best religious film.
Art, film, books, food, drink, all at Corner House, Manchester.
Now it's time for our What's On, a mini guide to things happening at Corner House and beyond. This week we actually have a third film just for selected screenings. It's called Fire in Babylon, and Andy's going to tell us a little bit about it.
I'm glad it's on because a few people in passing over the past few weeks have been asking me about this film. It's about the West Indian cricketers in the 1970s and 1980s, and in particular their relationship with Great Britain when they came over to play. It's got exactly the sorts of people you would think. There's plenty of footage and interviews with Viv Richards, people like Michael Holding, lots of archive footage, some contemporary footage of them as well. It gives a nice look at the cultural context, Britain in the 1970s and the early 1980s, how the West Indian cricket team gave a sense of pride to some of the migrant communities during that period when they were feeling a lot of racism within British society. It touches upon things like the urban uprisings from the early 1980s and how that all sort of fueled a kind of unrest, which in a sense the cricket both contributed to and also managed to dissipate. And that might be a bit controversial. Let's see what people think.
Okay, thank you. So that's Fire in Babylon, selected screenings from this Friday, the 10th of June. I'm also recommending this week the Library Theatre's production of Hard Times. This takes Dickens' classic to a disused mill in Ancoats. It's an exciting promenade piece of theatre that you walk through. I have a feeling that tickets are now only available from the venue on the day, but it's worth making the effort, and it's on until the 2nd of July, so you could well be lucky and get tickets. Find out more at www.librarytheatre.com. Something else I'd like to include in the What's On Guide this week is Castlefield Gallery's new exhibition. It's a local solo artist called Hilary Jack, and she collects broken objects and discarded materials from around the city or from charity shops, eBay. She then transforms them, gives them another life, and sometimes later returns them to their original locations. So the Hilary Jack exhibition previews on Thursday the 9th of June, but then it's open to the public from Friday the 10th of June to Sunday the 24th of July. So you've got plenty of time to check that out. That's Castlefield Gallery, just down the road from Corner House.
You're listening to the Corner House podcast, available from www.cornerhouse.org.
Now, last week, I promised that I would report back from the Venice Biennale and tell you some of my highlights. The Biennale itself was established over 100 years ago, and it's widely regarded as the big contemporary visual arts event that happens every 2 years, and where nations of the world fight for art supremacy or simply to show off big style with their long-established pavilions that they individually curate for each biennial, and they tend to pick one of their country's art stars. Success is partly evaluated by the length of the queue to get into each pavilion during the preview week. But don't worry, the British Pavilion did very well. We pretty much won this with alongside America, alongside the USA, because it took around 2 hours to get in to see Mike Nelson's immersive installation. There's also a curated exhibition that straddles the Giardini and the Arsenali called Illuminations, and that's with the first six letters as capitals for some reason. This theme is, well, a bit lame, really, to be honest. It's sort of referring to, quote, one of art's intrinsic characteristics. It is a unique and illuminating experience, unquote. Anyway, don't let that put you off. With so much work to see, there's some real gems. And if you can just spend a couple of days in Venice before the end of November, you most definitely should. The next part of the Biennale is lots of collateral events, so there's lots more exhibitions that have been independently curated and set up, scattered across the large and quite difficult to get around, and also if you get lost like me, at the centre of Venice. So the Biennale is very much a showcase, and the preview event is really the ultimate in networking for the contemporary visual art world, though of course there's a real commercial heart to this, so lots of big collectors getting wooed at dinners across the archipelago, and the rest of us left arguing with rather fierce people with clipboards. So to sum it up, a big art event, roughly split into three parts, the national pavilions from across the world, the curated Illuminations exhibition, and then a myriad of collateral events, performances, and other exhibitions taking place in the city. Now, there is so much to see and comment on that I've decided to restrict myself to three highlights. So these are my top three at the moment. It may change, but this is what, after a few days back, this is the things I'm remembering the most. My first one is by an artist called Thomas Hirschhorn, and it's called Crystal of Resistance. And this is also known as the Swiss Pavilion. Thomas Hirschhorn makes overwhelming installations, often completely filling a gallery with foil, with plastic, cardboard, and a whole plethora of found objects. However, if you pay close attention, there's a fair amount of criticism and subjectivity coming from the artist rather than it just being about the spectacle. And he certainly doesn't disappoint with Crystals of Resistance. He still has a lot of foil and gaffer tape, and everything has changed on the inside, and he uses magazines, old mobile phones, broken bottles, but it creates a really powerful installation, one you can really lose yourself and start to think about the different elements of society that he is critiquing. You can find out a bit more about that at www.crystalofresistance.com. My second highlight, we're going to go over to the French Pavilion for Christian Boltanski's Chance. And here, the veteran multimedia artist is creating an impressive installation in the main room of the pavilion called The Wheel of Fortune. All the work's about chance and luck and fate. But here we go right back to the beginning with a large strip of photographs of newborn babies that are moving around a huge steel infrastructure that's several meters high. And on occasion, a doorbell rings and one baby's face appears on a monitor. Is this a chosen one, perhaps? What will this baby's fate be? Is it all random? They're the kind of questions that this piece of work is getting to. So that was Christian Boltanski's Chance in the French Pavilion. For my third choice, I've picked a collateral event, as I didn't want to stay just with the national pavilions, and it's called Future Pass. It's an exhibition on two sites, and it's pretty much full of Chinese and Japanese artwork that definitely has the requisite amount of kitsch, of pop culture, of technology that you'd expect of exhibitions from the East. Stereotypes aside, this really delivers on both excitement and also just the sheer variety of media and the number of artists from all stages of their career, so very established artists like Takahashi Murakami's design imagery, Liu Yi's paintings, there's also Chen Shih-hung's earth sculptures, and there's also some really good technology pieces, including some 3D images for mobile phones, where you don't even need 3D glasses, and these really, really interesting things that everyone spent a lot of time trying to work out how they work. So that's my three highlights. So that third one was Future Pass. It's at two venues in Venice. There's also some awards as well that are given out. And the Golden Lion, which is the most prestigious, went to Germany's Pavilion. And this was by the late Christoph Schlingensief, who died of cancer last year. He's a German filmmaker, theatre and opera director, and artist. And the exhibition that he has created in the German Pavilion is an extremely theatrical, larger-than-life, cathedral-like installation, incorporating his artwork, films, and documentation from a project he was doing where he was trying to build a school and an opera house in Burkina Faso. Again, really powerful, quite emotional. Obviously, you've got this subtext that he's no longer here, but he started this project and it was then fulfilled to his directions. But much more than that, really creating an atmosphere, and the passion is evident from him and the kind of work he was doing. Really, really enjoyed spending a lot of time in there. There was also a prize for British artist Haroon Mirza, who's also a Northern lad, he's from Sheffield, and he won the Biennial's Prize for Best Artist Under 40. This wasn't actually my favourite piece by him. I have seen stronger examples of his work, but it's a very nice understated one involving a golden nugget and a speaker. So do check that out if you're visiting the Venice Biennale. Phew, so I could mention so much more, but ideally you can look it out for yourself if you can make it over to Venice this summer or autumn. Tickets for the Biennale are about €20 and it's open until the 27th of November.
Art, film, books, food, drink, all at Corner House, Manchester.
Now it's time for our recommendation of the week, and this week our digital producer Sarah Leach gives you the lowdown on our new website.
Okay, so some of you might have noticed that we launched our new website this week. We've been working on it for a while now, probably since the start of the year, and we just wanted to create something that was really easy to use, was packed full of content, and look good as well, really. So like the old website, you can still search for the films that we screen and the exhibitions that we show up in the galleries. And we've got quite a nice little feature on the top right-hand corner, a What's On guide, where you can pop in what you're interested in and find out what's going on today, tomorrow, this week, or in the coming months. So that's a real range of stuff from film screenings, workshops, talks, our quizzes, our exhibition previews. And you can still also download our weekly calendar from the website too. So if you find that helpful to plan your trips, that's also on there. As per the old site, you can still browse our online bookstore, check out our menus in the cafe, take a look at our creative opportunities, as well as find out about us as an organisation and things like venue hire as well. Another nice new function is the comments facility, where you can tell us what you think of the films you've seen, the exhibitions you've been to, or the events that you've attended. Whether it's a Q&A screening with a director, or you've come along to a film and you absolutely love it and you want to tell people about it, we want to know your thoughts. So just go onto the website and tell us what you think. Now, just because we've shifted to a new looking website doesn't mean you can't search our film and art archive. If you want to look back at films that we played years and years ago, you could do that on the film page and again with the art page by searching through director, curator, artist. So that function's still there as well, which is good. There's loads of great things I could say about the website, but the best thing to do is to have a look yourself. So it's www.cornerhouse.org. And as this is a new thing for us, we'd really appreciate your feedback on it. Do you like the website? You find it easy to use? Maybe there's a few little things you're not too sure about. Do feedback to us. You can email us at comments@cornerhouse.org. We know we can't get it perfect first time. We really want to mould this site so it's easy for you to use and you get what you want out of it. So it's really important that you do give us your feedback. So hope you like the site and happy browsing.
Thank you, Sarah. And of course, thank you again to Rachel and Andy for being my regular contributors and joining me today. You can find out more about everything we've talked about on our website. That's www.cornerhouse.org. Alternatively, follow us on Twitter, join the Cornerhouse Facebook group, and I'll see you next week.
You've been listening to the Cornerhouse podcast.